Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story.
Ireland Crimes and Mysteries is presented by Go Loud, Ireland's leading audio publisher and the home of Irish podcasts. Find new episodes on the podcast first on the Go Loud app and on your favourite podcast platform.
It was Sunday, the 24th of March, 1968, Mother's Day in Ireland. At Cork Airport, families stood near the windows waving as Aer Lingus Flight 712 prepared for its short hop over to London. The green and white Vickers Viscount, tail number EIAOM, had made that journey hundreds of times before. It was a reliable plane, well known to passengers and crew alike. On board were 57 passengers and a crew of four. They were ordinary people travelling for work, for visits, for holidays. Some were immigrants heading back to London after seeing family. Others were English tourists returning home from a weekend in Ireland. And among them were mothers, fathers and children, each with their own story, each expecting to be in Heathrow before lunchtime. Captain Bernard O'Byrne was 35 and was an experienced pilot from Dublin, known by colleagues as calm and capable. His co-pilot, First Officer Paul Heffernan, was just 22. He was enthusiastic, methodical and already regarded as one of Aer Lingus' most promising young pilots. The cabin crew consisted of Anne Kelly from Dublin and Mary Coughlin from Cork, both of which were 21 years old and part of a new generation of flight attendants representing Ireland abroad. Friendly, professional and proud of their jobs. The passengers included Jerome Jerry McCormack, a 36-year-old farmer from County Mayo. He was flying back to work in England. Margaret Walsh, a young woman travelling to visit her sister. And Jack Furlong, a 24-year-old construction worker from Wexford who'd been home for the weekend. Each one said goodbye that morning, never imagining it would be for the last time. Flight 712, or Echo India Alpha Oscar Mike, as it was known by call sign, took off from Cork at 10:32 a.m, climbing smoothly over the Irish coast. The weather was clear, calm and perfect for flying. From the windows, passengers could see the soft blue of the Atlantic stretching beneath them, and on the horizon, the faint outline of Wexford's southern coastline. Inside the cabin, the mood was light. This was a short flight, less than an hour. Anne Kelly and Mary Coughlin would have just begun preparing the tea trolley. Some passengers settled into the Sunday papers, others chatted with each other. It was kind of an uneventful morning flight where nothing much would be different from any other day. And that was exactly how everyone liked it. At 11:10 a.m, Flight 712 was cruising at around 17,000 feet over the sea south of Tusker Rock, just off the Wexford coast. The lighthouse below had stood there for many years, a silent marker on the edge of Ireland. Out at Tusker Rock, the lighthouse, its beams automated and steady, a fixed point on the edge of Ireland's coastline. No one that day could have known what was unfolding overhead. A few minutes later, a broken transmission came through to Shannon Control. The voice, believed to be that of Captain O'Byrne, was calm at first, then cut sharply mid-sentence. 12,000 feet, descending, spinning rapidly. Then, without warning, radio contact with Flight 712 stopped. At first there was no alarm. Short radio waves happened occasionally. Sometimes the signal flickered as planes crossed from one control zone to another. But a few minutes later, when air traffic controllers in Shannon and London both failed to raise the crew, white unease began to spread. By 11:25 a.m, radar operators realised the aircraft had vanished from their screens. Moments earlier, that brief and broken radio message had come through from the cockpit. The crew reported that they were 12,000 feet descending, spinning rapidly, before the transmission was cut short. After that, there was nothing. No follow-up call, no confirmation, just static. Controllers tried to raise the flight repeatedly, but it never responded again. The last recorded radar position placed it roughly 10 miles off the Wexford coast, close enough that, on a clear morning, the crew would likely have been able to see land. Back at Heathrow, the staff at Aer Lingus prepared for the plane's arrival as usual. It was due in at 11:50 a.m. Families waited in the arrivals area, scanning the board for updates. But when the time passed with no sign of the flight, unease began to set in. A delay, maybe? A diversion? Maybe the weather? It wasn't until a call came through from Dublin that staff began to realise something far more serious was unfolding. Within the hour, the Irish Coast Guard, the Royal Navy and local fishing boats were alerted. Search planes were dispatched from Baldonnell and RAF Valley in Wales, heading towards the stretch of sea south of Wexford. As word reached the families, shock turned to disbelief. This was Aer Lingus, Ireland's flagship airline. It couldn't just vanish. There had to be some mistake. By that afternoon, debris began to wash ashore. First pieces of the aircraft's fuselage, then a few seat cushions, then, devastatingly, a child's shoe. For the people living along the Wexford coast, that Sunday would be remembered forever. The day the sea brought tragedy to their doorstep. By early afternoon, rescue calls had gone out across Ireland and the Irish Sea. Coast Guard stations from Rosslare to Waterford reported sightings of scattered wreckage drifting north on the tide. Fishermen who had been out that morning began hauling pieces of the aircraft into their nets. Panels of aluminium, a seat cushion, and as I said, that child's shoe. The search became one of the largest ever mounted in Irish waters. Helicopters from Baldonnell and the RAF Valley in Anglesey joined the effort, along with naval vessels and trawlers pressed into service from Wexford and Dunmore East. Throughout the afternoon, the shoreline filled with locals scanning the horizon, hoping for survivors, but already fearing the worst. Back in Cork, Aer Lingus set up an emergency centre. Staff phoned Heathrow and Dublin every few minutes, still clinging to the faint hope that the flight had made an emergency landing somewhere along the coast. At Heathrow, relatives were quietly led to a private room. Some had brought flowers for Mother's Day. Others still believed there had been a radio failure. By evening, officials could no longer soften the truth. Flight 712 had been lost at sea. That night, weather conditions turned against the searchers. The light wind that had made for perfect flying weather earlier now stirred up a mist that clung to the water. Despite this, dozens of vessels stayed out through the night, sweeping grids south of Tusker Rock Lighthouse. By dawn on Monday the 25th of March, rescue crews began recovering bodies. Most were found floating close together, suggesting the aircraft had come down largely intact. Every discovery was logged and photographed. The bodies were brought to Our Lady's Island and later identified at Wexford General Hospital. For the families waiting there, those hours were almost unbearable. The lists came slowly, a handful of names at a time. In the following days, all 61 people on board were confirmed dead. Only 14 bodies were ever recovered. Among them were the two flight attendants, Anne Kelly and Mary Coughlin, whose colleagues from Aer Lingus accompanied their coffins home. The rest remained somewhere beneath the sea, along with the wreckage. With no survivors and only fragments of wreckage to examine, speculation began immediately. First theory was the most straightforward, structural failure. The Viscount was a dependable aircraft, but had been in service since 1957. Investigators initially believed part of the tail or elevator assembly might have broken away mid-flight, sending the aircraft into a steep descent. Then fragments began to tell a slightly different story. Some pieces showed signs of impact from outside, as though struck by another object, and reports emerged of fishermen and radar operators who'd seen military aircraft in the area that morning. This fueled another theory, that Flight 712 had collided with or been struck by a British military plane during low-level manoeuvres. At the time, RAF Brodie in Wales regularly carried out exercises over the Irish Sea, but the Irish and British governments publicly denied that any near miss had occurred, but the rumours persisted for decades. The official Irish investigation in 1970 was cautious. It concluded that the accident was likely caused by a structural failure, possibly of the tailplane, but added that the initiating cause of the failure could not be determined. It also noted the presence of a Royal Navy bowfighter reported in the area earlier that day, though it found no proof of a collision. For the families, these technical explanations offered little comfort. They wanted clarity, not engineering language. Relatives spoke of how painful it was to read speculation in the papers while still waiting for their loved ones' remains to be found. Many never received anything, no bodies, no belongings, just an official letter and a Aer Lingus condolence card. In Ireland, the loss stunned the nation. Aer Lingus had an impeccable safety record. Commercial air travel was still something people dressed up for. The idea that a routine flight could vanish from the clear skies seemed unimaginable. Flags were lowered to half-mast across airports. In churches, the following Sunday, priests read the names of the victims aloud. At St. Patrick's Church in Cork, mourners filled the aisles for a memorial service for the two stewardesses. In Wexford, local fishermen stood shoulder to shoulder with Coast Guard crews who'd spent days on the water. In Dublin, Aer Lingus employees lined the runways in silence as a plane performed a flypast. Even abroad, the storyline made headlines. British, American and European newspapers carried front page photographs of grieving families and wreckage being lifted from the sea. Back in Wexford, pieces of the plane continued to wash ashore for weeks. Seat frames, life jackets, small personal items. Local residents gathered and handed everything to the Gardaí, who catalogued each object before sending it to Dublin for analysis. When the official report was finally published, it raised more questions than answers. It confirmed that the Viscount had descended rapidly from 17,000 feet, broke apart before impact and hit the sea at high speed. But why that happened remained uncertain. Over time, frustration grew. The relatives wanted another inquiry. This time, one that would include British radar data and military logs. It would take more than 30 years, 2002 to be exact, before the re-examination finally happened. For now, though, in 1968, all anyone knew was that 61 lives had ended within minutes, in calm weather, on a Sunday morning that had begun with blue skies. For the families left behind, the sea off Wexford would never again be the same. It would be always the place where their world stopped. For decades after the crash, the question of what really happened to Flight 712 refused to fade. Officially, the 1970 report had closed the case, citing a probable structural failure in the tail section. But that conclusion never sat easily with the families, or with many in aviation circles. There had been too many unanswered questions and too many inconsistencies in the evidence that was recovered. By the early 1990s, Ireland had changed. The country had begun to look back more critically at events once considered untouchable, from industrial disasters to historical tragedies. The loss of Flight 712 came back into focus, especially as surviving relatives began to share their memories publicly for the first time. One of the most vocal voices was Neil McCormack, whose brother Jerome had been aboard. He and others gathered documents, witness notes and press cuttings and pressed the government for a fresh look. Their persistence paid off. In the late 1990s, the Department of Public Enterprise authorised the Air Incident Investigation Unit, the AAIU, to re-examine every piece of evidence available, including data and testimony that hadn't been fully considered in the original inquiry. This new review, completed in 2002, ran to hundreds of pages. It drew on radar logs, wreckage analysis, weather data and statements from witnesses on both sides of the Irish Sea. For the first time, the AAIU worked jointly with the UK Air Accident Investigation Branch, the AAIB. An unprecedented level of cooperation between the two countries on an aviation case of this kind. The AAIU team found that much of the Viscount's wreckage had been spread over a wide area of seabed, but the pattern suggested the aircraft had started to break up before it hit the water. Metal fatigue or flutter, small vibrations that grow under stress, might have caused a failure in the tailplane or elevator, leading the aircraft to lose control. Yet the report also acknowledged the evidence didn't point neatly to one explanation. There were signs of external damage of unknown origin and testimony from multiple witnesses describing other aircraft, possibly military jets, flying at low level in the same airspace at roughly the same time. British Ministry of Defence provided files confirming that Royal Air Force, Beaufighter and Canberra aircraft had been conducting routine training in the Irish Sea that morning, but none, they said, were within 30 miles of Flight 712's route. The AAIU couldn't prove or disprove that claim. It concluded that a mid-air collision was highly unlikely, but cannot entirely rule it out. For families who had waited more than 30 years, the findings were bittersweet. The report confirmed what many already suspected, that the cause could not be proven beyond doubt. But it also validated something deeper, that their loved ones hadn't simply fallen out of the sky. Something went wrong that morning, and it was not because of an error by the crew. Captain O'Byrne and First Officer Heffernan were praised in the report for their professionalism and experience. Both had excellent records and no indication of fatigue or error. The cabin crew, Anne Kelly and Mary Coughlin, were remembered by their colleagues as exemplary, calm, capable and kind to their passengers. Aer Lingus formally commended them again at the 2002 memorial ceremony attended by families of all 61 victims. For the relatives, the reinvestigation brought renewed grief. Old wounds reopened as families revisited evidence and photographs from the wreckage. But it also brought solidarity. Many of them met in person for the first time during the process, forming friendships that have lasted ever since. Neil McCormack said later that the review didn't give answers, but it gave recognition. For him, the greatest relief was knowing the case would never again be dismissed as solved and forgotten. Journalists covering the 2002 findings described it as one of Ireland's most thorough post-war investigations. Still, when asked whether it had changed anything, most relatives said the same thing. It confirmed the uncertainty, but at least now it's official. For Aer Lingus, the disaster remained a defining tragedy. In the years after the re-examination, the airline established a permanent archive in Dublin and contributed funding for the memorial sculpture in Wexford. While it still mentioned Flight 712 during annual safety briefings, not as a technical case study, but as a reminder of the responsibility they carry every day. By the 40th anniversary in 2008, public interest had returned again. RTE aired a documentary called The Tusker Rock Mystery, revisiting the events with newly uncovered footage and interviews with surviving rescue crews. The programme highlighted the human side, the Coast Guard members who'd spent days at sea recovering wreckage, and the families who had received only fragments of their loved ones' belongings. One rescuer interviewed on camera said he still remembered the smell of aviation fuel and the eerie quiet over the water. "Just never forget something like that," he said. For the families, every anniversary brought the same mixed emotion, gratitude that people still remembered, and pain that the truth remained beyond reach. In 2018, the 50th anniversary service was held in Rosslare. The Irish Coast Guard laid a wreath at sea, and the names of all 61 victims were read aloud, from Captain O'Byrne and his crew to the youngest passengers, including a six-year-old girl travelling with her parents. At the memorial site near Our Lady's Island, relatives gathered beneath the sculpture of 61 bird-like figures facing towards the sea. Many said that, for the first time, they felt their loved ones were finally at peace. More than 50 years have passed since Flight 712 went down off the Wexford coast, but for many Irish families, it still feels like only yesterday. The names on the memorial at Our Lady's Island represent more than a list. They're reminders of parents, children, co-workers and friends whose lives ended without explanation. For the people of Wexford, it's a story that never really left the shoreline. Local fishermen still talk about the search, the days spent combing the sea, the quiet return to port at night when the scale of what had happened began to sink in. Those who helped never forgot it, and neither did the families who came to thank them. In the years since, there have been books, documentaries and official reports, but also simple gestures. Every March, flowers appear by the memorial. Aer Lingus continues to honour the flight crew. And at the 50th anniversary, the Coast Guard laid a wreath at sea, not far from where the wreckage rests on the seabed. The AAIU's 2002 review stands as the final word on the investigation, ruling that the aircraft broke up in mid-air, most likely from structural failure, though the trigger remains unknown. What that means is that no one was ever blamed. No single cause was ever proven. And maybe that's what makes this story so haunting. That sense of something ordinary, something trusted, vanishing without warning. In a country where aviation disasters are rare, the loss of Flight 712 marked a turning point. It changed how air safety was handled, how international cooperation worked, and how grief was shared publicly. But at its heart, it's still a human story. 61 people, each with their own plans and hopes, lost on a clear spring morning. For their families and for everyone who still stands on that Wexford coastline each year, the Tusker Rock disaster isn't about conspiracy or mystery anymore. It's about memory, dignity, and love that never fades.
So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership, and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto-download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.